Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson. I am thrilled to welcome to Talk Nation Radio this week Andy Shalal, a candidate for mayor in the city of Washington, D.C., a longtime activist, artist, entrepreneur, friend known to many, many people in the activist world and in Washington, D.C., but now a political candidate, a new Andy Shalal. Andy, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you so much.
Maybe we should give people a little bit of your background briefly. You came to the United States around age 10?
Yes, in 1966, came to Washington, D.C.
From Iraq?
From Baghdad, Iraq.
What was the reason and what was your experience when you got here?
My father was offered a position with the Arab League. At that point, the Arab League was the League of Arab Nations. It was centered in Egypt, and my father had been involved in government in Baghdad and was kind of disillusioned and wanted to find something else to do, basically, and ended up being offered this position to be representative for the Arab League in the United States. And of course, that was a very coveted position, being able to travel and come to America, something that many people in that part of the world wanted to do. So he ended up taking the position and we ended up here. And we thought we'd be here for 2 years, and we've been here ever since 1966, which makes it very close to 50 years.
How was the transition initially for you? Was it difficult?
Well, it was. I mean, a 10-year-old boy just finishing up elementary school, coming into middle school, trying to meet new friends, learn a whole new language, a whole new culture, a whole new way of doing things was really quite a transition and quite a culture shock. And, you know, like everything else, you adjust and you align yourself and you make it.
Where else did you go to school? How did you get from there to where you are now as the owner of the restaurants where all of the good organizations hold their events in Washington and an artist and an activist?
So we ended up coming and lived in Arlington. I went to middle school. We were placed in seventh grade at that time. You know, shortly thereafter, we started moving up, and I finished high school when I was 15. And started college just because the American system was not as rigorous, I guess, as the system in Baghdad. And so we ended up finishing high school sooner than we normally would have. So I started college at Catholic University, went to Catholic University because my parents believed in Catholic education, even though we're Muslims. They were big believers in the Catholic educational system. We went to Catholic schools when we were younger in elementary school in Baghdad. And so we went here, we finished school. I majored in pre-med, didn't really like it, didn't want to stay in pre-med, wanted to do other things, ended up then going to Howard University Medical School and dropping out very shortly thereafter. Here I am at 19 out of college, later going into medical school, then dropping out, and thought that I needed to do something else with my life. I wasn't ready to commit to a life to be a doctor. I didn't like the idea of it. That's not my passion. So I dropped out of school, and my parents didn't find out actually about it till much later, and ended up traveling. And in the meantime, I'd got married, had two kids, then got a divorce, traveled, came back to Washington, and thought, you know, along the way I learned the restaurants, because restaurants were an easy way for me to connect, make some cash, do what I need to do in a transitional period of my life. So I worked in restaurants and enjoyed them immensely. And my father at some point had a restaurant earlier as well. When he left the Arab League and decided to stay in this country, he bought a small little restaurant that we worked in when I was in high school. So it kind of came back full circle to it. Went into business a little bit with my father. It was good. I learned a lot, and decided to open my first restaurant in Washington. Did well. Opened up a second and a third and a fourth, and sold them along the way. And kind of along the way, developed my political interests. Really, I've always been very progressive in my politics. Always been involved in other things. Anti-war stuff was very, very big. And you know, back in the late '80s. And right into 90, when the Iraq War began, with the first Gulf War, I was very active in that and became more and more active in the political system, started forming organizations, and part of movements that are already in place, worked on anti-war activism for a long time, opened up a bookstore, and decided to do Busboys and Poets, kind of a response to all of my experiences, plus what was going on politically around me. I thought that we needed places where people can connect, places where progressives of different walks of life, different cultures, black people, white people, others, come together and kind of share their progressive ideology with one another, be able to reinforce it. And so that's where Busboys and Poets really was born, out of that desire to create community spaces that can bring people together and help them to ignite or excite movements that are percolating.
It seems odd to you or me, but people outside of Washington, D.C. don't always know what Busboys and Poets means. What is Busboys and Poets?
Busboys and Poets is a gathering space, as I mentioned, named in honor of Langston Hughes, who worked as a busboy while writing poetry here in Washington, D.C. And one night he was writing his poetry, slipped a group of poems underneath the plate of a very famous poet who was dining in the dining room where the young Langston Hughes was working. Bacha Lindsay was the poet. He read the poetry, nodded approvingly. The next day, the young Langston Hughes was on his way to work and picked up the newspaper, as he did every day, to read on it that it said that he had just discovered a busboy poet, that Bacha Lindsay had just discovered a busboy poet. So when he arrived at the hotel, there was paparazzi everywhere and people taking pictures of him, and sort of launched his career into fame. Ended up leaving the hotel shortly thereafter and making a living out of his writing and his poetry.
And Busboys and Poets, the restaurant, the series of restaurants now has become
we've opened four, and there are two more coming up in the next year and a half.
And it really has served an incredible function of allowing people to meet and gather and hold events and discussions and films and arts that I don't know what Washington, D.C. would be without it, and many other cities would benefit from having something similar.
We get lots of requests for to have Busboys and Poets in various places. So it's kind of cool, the interest that this place has generated. It's very exciting.
Yes, I may have asked you to open one here in Charlottesville, Virginia, a few or a dozen times. Now you, but I know you as in that role and as the artist who created the collages on the walls, and as an activist in D.C. who opposed a subsidy for Northrop Grumman and drove them over here to Virginia. Thanks a lot, who backed a higher minimum wage for Walmart and all of these good causes, and mm-hmm. someone who goes out and risks arrest for fighting climate change and so forth. How do you shift from that to being a political candidate? Why do you want to be a mayor?
I've always wondered why more progressive folks don't run for office. And I know that sometimes people think, you need to stay on the outside, that you're on the outside, you're much more effective, etc. And I understand that. But I think as you get older, you feel like, there are other activists that are coming through the ranks, and they need to do what I've been doing. Sometimes you need inside-outside strategy. You need people on the inside to help, make the progressive changes that oftentimes I think we fight for on the outside. And I know that politics is very different than activism. Activism, you just have one perspective or one idea that you want to be able to push forward. Politics is a lot of triangulation and bringing people together, but sometimes we seem to forget that the center isn't always in one place. It moves, it shifts. And so that shift is created through the push and pull that happens inside and outside government. And I think there is a way that you can open up that space to try to shift that center, because for a long time people say, oh, this is the center, and always want, like, the center is not like some sort of stagnant set of standards that we adhere by. It changes every day. It certainly changes from over a decade, and sometimes in a very drastic way. So what's acceptable today may have been very radical 10 years ago. I mean, look at gay marriage, for instance. Who'd have ever imagined this would be mainstream today? I think you need that inside-outside strategy. And sometimes, I always feel like when people talk about politics being dirty and you stay out of politics, like, you know what? Politics affects me. It affects every one of us. So whether we get involved or not, it's still going to affect us. So I don't want to be a recipient of that. I'd like to be a participant of it.
Hmm. right. You may not be interested in politics, but politics is interested in you.
Absolutely. You can't get away from it.
We are speaking with Andy Shalal, candidate for mayor of Washington, D.C. So if you are mayor, what do you want to accomplish? What legislation, what policy changes, what do you hope to push for in that position?
Well, there's so many issues, I think, out there. And I look at my city, Washington, D.C., my adoptive city, so to speak. I've lived in the area for many, many years, lived inside and outside of Washington for many years. And the last time I moved here was 2006. So I've been here living in D.C. since 2006. It's a city that is quite unique. And unlike, Vegas, what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas. What happens in D.C. tends to have a ripple effect regionally and nationally and even globally sometimes. So I think Washington should not be underestimated as an important incubator for great ideas. I think there are so many great ideas that can become model for other cities and how business should be conducted. It's a very progressive city, which is a great beginning. But I think sometimes economically and otherwise fiscally it tends to be very conservative and tends to have a fairly closed political circle. And I think that closeness has created this disenfranchisement in people, or this sense of disempowerment that people have gotten over the years, and it's become very incestuous in some way. So I think helping to open it up to citizen activism and citizen politicians, I think, is a big, big plus. I think there is a lot that could happen because this is D.C. has become a tale of two cities. I think we've heard that in other cities as well, where you have a city that's thriving and doing amazingly well, and then a city that is getting more and more depressed and more people are falling between the cracks. This is a city now that has 20% of its population living below the federal standards of poverty. This is a disgrace. I mean, as far as I see it, it's a city where 2 out of 3 black kids are in poverty. 2 out of 3 black kids drop out of school, high school, before they finish high school. These are alarming figures. This is our collective disgrace. This is our collective failure. It's awful. And it's not talked about. And, one would hear that the city oftentimes is rated so high in so many metrics. It's always at the top of, Forbes magazine, most livable city, at the top of Business Week, whatever, more bicycle lanes and more restaurants, more grass-fed burgers and more beer gardens, more or less. And this is fine. All these things are great. I'm not trying to diminish those. But also, it has this other underbelly, a real serious problem, where it's a city that needs a lot of help. A lot of people are hurting. And I think it's our duty at this point, certainly mine, I've never been one to sit on the sidelines, to engage the politicians that we have and ask them, why have they ignored these people? And why do they keep saying the city's doing great when all of these things are happening?
Should Washington, D.C. restore some value to its minimum wage, or what's commonly called raising the minimum wage, although it's actually putting some value back in there?
Yeah, I mean, I've been talking about these issues and testifying on these issues for many, many years. Seems like decades at this point. I like to lead by example. So our place at Busboys of Poets, for instance, we pay a minimum wage of $10.25 an hour. Now, hardly anyone makes that. Most of them make more. We're working to change the tip minimum wage as well, trying to get that to be higher than the normal tip minimum wage that's here in the city. Again, that's starting to gain some traction, and there's legislation now all over in our city council trying to raise the minimum wage. We've been at the forefront of talking about the Sick Leave Act. For a long time, we pushed for sick leave for all, and the city council voted sick leave but exempted tipped workers, which became problematic because who wants a sick waiter to be waiting on them? So we fought for that. Now there's some legislation with the possibility of that being pushed forward. Everything from smoking bans to better working conditions, we've been at the forefront to make that possible, make it happen, and really set an example so other businesses and other restaurants can say, this is possible. Because oftentimes we think of, when we think of business, especially small business, we try to sort of copy each other. Small business comes into place and you have certain percentages of what your food cost is supposed to be, your labor cost, your overhead and all that, and you set up those standards. And then it's business as usual. Sometimes you have to begin with the end in mind, begin with saying, you know what, I'm not going to just look at one bottom line. I'm going to look at all the bottom lines. I'm going to look at profit, of course, but I'm also going to look at how I'm impacting the environment, how I'm impacting my community, how I'm impacting my workers, and set up a business model that meets all those standards. And I think that's what we've been at the forefront to help make possible.
Some of those rankings of Washington, D.C. are rankings in comparison to other cities like Detroit that are completely collapsing. And there are problems facing all of our cities that many people think need really radical solutions. We have homeless people and empty houses in Washington, D.C. and everywhere else. Some people are proposing creating a public bank in a city or a state. What sort of solutions are you interested in pursuing that that haven't been talked about yet?
Well, I think some of the ideas that we're talking about is how can we cut poverty in half in the next 5 years, for instance. Now, it sounds like a big, huge thing to deal with. Poverty is such a big thing. But really, if you break down poverty into pieces, you can understand what poverty is and what you can do to alleviate it. Part of getting people out of poverty is having a living wage. That's the first thing. If I'm going to have someone be incentivized to wake up in the morning, go to work all day, come home, they have to be able to pay for their food, their shelter, at the very minimum. And if that's not met, what's the point of doing this over and over again for someone? Obviously, it'd be pointless. So people stay in poverty because we don't incentivize work. So that's one thing we can do. The other thing is I want to take any barriers between a person who needs a job and the job. So take transportation for instance. Why can't we do transportation for free for people that are in need? Public transportation should be a means for people to get from where they are to their job or to a museum or to something other than their space that they're in. The more you can have people be mobile, the more thriving of a marketplace and economy you can have. If people are able to switch jobs easily, then jobs will become more attuned to people's needs. So I think that's really important to be able to give those options. Child care. We need to have child care that's accessible. We need to have child care that's part of a wraparound services that goes around our schools so that a person who has a child and needs to get a job can easily find child care that's accessible, that's priced accordingly, or even free. These are done in many other countries in the world, and they tend to do very well and have a much higher, happier quotient than we do. We don't think about these things. It's a dog-eat-dog kind of situation. I don't think that's a sustainable model for society. We need to reinvigorate the social contract between us and everyone around us. And I think that's been lost at some point through this market idea that everything should be thrown out to the market. I'm not against markets because I'm in them and I do them well. But I am against markets when it comes to basic human rights. We can't monetize or market that for schools, affordable housing, child care. All these things should not be left just for the market. Those are things that are going to impact the entire society, and I think we owe it to each other to make it accessible, make it transparent, make it available for everyone, because everyone benefits.
I remember reading that one highway interchange in Springfield, so just outside of Washington, D.C., cost more than the entire budget of the metro system in Washington, D.C. And of course, even within Washington, the most environmentally destructive form of transportation, the streets, are provided free for everybody.
Exactly.
What about providing the metro free for everybody?
Well, I mean, the big argument is always like, where are we going to get the money? Where are we going to get the money? Well, we seem to always find money when we want to. There's no doubt about it that even in the worst of conditions, the worst of circumstances, the worst of recessions,
stadiums can be built.
It's about resources. It's all about priorities.
Yeah.
You know that, and I know that. And I think we need to stop kidding ourselves thinking that, because when I proposed this idea, somebody said, well, the WMATA is hurting. And so, you know, the budget is going to be a problem. How are you going to pay for it? I said, well, you cannot use poor people to pay your public transportation budget. That makes no sense at all, because you're going to have to pay for services on the other end. So either you pay it on this end and empower people, or you pay it on the other end and keep them in a state of poverty. And, you know, it makes you wonder what's going on. Why can't we see that? You know, why is it so difficult to sell that to people? It's an easier sell here in D.C., frankly, than other cities or states I've lived in.
D.C. public schools is another area where what happens has ripple effects and people learn about it and watch it. What notions do you have for improving D.C. schools?
I think D.C. schools are really kind of central to any debate about any kind of reforms. Schools, as you know, are very central to communities. You know, even people that don't have kids in schools care about the schools. When they go to buy property or move into a neighborhood, the first thing people ask is, how are the schools? They ask that because schools determine oftentimes how safe a neighborhood is, how tight a neighborhood is, how nice a neighborhood is, how clean it's going to be, all of those things. You know, the school sort of sets that standard. And so what's happening here at the, you know, those new corporate reforms that have taken place since Michelle Reed came 7 years ago, it's created this sort of competition between schools. And the competition between schools, one might think, well, good, competition is good. That means that schools will improve. But what happens is we pitted schools against one another. And what is created is the sort of complete abolishing of the community school idea. It used to be the school was a center of a community. People go to it. The kids walk to school, or they walk to school, or they have friends that they grow up with. The parents know each other. They know each other's kids. They look out for them. There is wraparound services around that school. There is ESL classes. There's adult education classes. There are art fairs and music fairs and soccer games, and all of that happens with that school, and a community is formed. Right now, that's been completely dismissed. Not only are they closing schools left and right because of lack of enrollment, and lack of enrollment happens because charter schools pop up. So a school starts to fail because there's not enough services to really make it succeed, and it's replaced with a charter school that may also fail. And you end up with this sort of constant switching of schools. So parents can live in a neighborhood, let's say. They may start at an elementary school. A year later, they don't like it. So instead of fighting for it, standing up and testifying, going out there and empowering themselves and turning the school around, they have the option to shop. So they'll start shopping around, and they'll find a school 2 miles, 5 miles, 10 miles away from where they live. They have to pack their kids in the morning, drag them across town, drop them off, come back, and have to turn that around. The kids lose connections to anybody in the neighborhood because everybody's choosing a different school. And suddenly you've sort of shredded the neighborhood.
So how do you reverse that? How do you undo that?
You stop closing schools. You begin by stopping closing schools. And you commit yourself that there's no such thing as a failing school. If we fail a school, that means we all failed. That we have to work and double up and make sure that there are enough wraparound services to make the school succeed. We have examples around us. Not like this is new. We have Montgomery County and Fairfax County, which has some of the best school systems in the country. They don't really have any real charter schools to speak of. They've been able to do it. We also look around and see examples of charter schools that have proliferated, like in New Orleans, right after Katrina. Charter schools came with a vengeance. Almost all the schools in New Orleans are charter schools now. And they're failing. So people always assume that charter schools are going to do better than the public school system, but in reality, there's just as many good charter schools as there are public schools, many bad charter schools as there are bad public schools. And here in D.C., the way that it works is the charter schools are, they're called public charter schools. The only public part is the money. So they take public money, and they basically do whatever they want with it. There's not a lot of oversight. There's not a lot of transparency. You know, they can do spend the money any way they want to. They oftentimes pay their CEOs or heads of the school big bucks and skimping on how the money gets to the kid. So we need to know, parents need to get involved, and we need to know as parents how much money is actually going to the kids. That information is completely out of reach. There's no ability for a parent to know how the money is actually spent in the school. So, I mean, that's one beginning. The charter school idea also needs to be cut back. That I know that there are some great charter schools and some parents love their charter school, but there's just as many failing schools that we need to double down, reassess, and really commit ourselves to public schools, put the public back in public schools. That's one important thing. Parents, communities have been disempowered, this sort of mayoral oversight of the school system, where the chancellor only is beholden to the mayor. And the school board has been neutered here in D.C., has created this sort of disconnect between the parents and the community and the stakeholders and the school system. So there's this huge distance between them. There's been an extreme overemphasis on testing, very high-stakes testing, where everything is connected to the test, where the teacher is put in an impossible situation sometimes to raise the grades of the test. So it has created a lot of anxiety. It has created a lot of cheating. We've had scandal after scandal of this cheating on the test because everything depends on that test. That teacher's life or death depends on the test. Either the teacher stays or goes depending on the test. How much the teacher makes depends on the test. So there's so many other factors that determine whether or not a kid can succeed, yet the test is the only real thing that they follow. The third thing is how we assess teachers. Teachers are assessed in this sort of archaic, rather cumbersome, heavy-handed approach of assessment that is like a one-size-fits-all. So it's called impact. So you have 5 assessments to every teacher, and usually, or sometimes you have non-educators doing the assessment. They check off boxes, and teachers are given a grade, and they're stressed out. So we created this sort of no child left untested, no teacher left unstressed, a situation that is really a lose-lose for everybody. And it has not improved our school system. In the 7 years since Michelle Rhee came to the D.C. public school system and tried to reinvent it, things have actually gotten worse. The gap between high-end kids and kids on the bottom has only widened. And when we say kids at the bottom, we're meaning black kids. That's the only widened. And that's not going to turn around unless we take a break and start looking at how we can do better in all of our schools as a community and commit once again to say that we as a society have a contract with all of us here to make sure that our school system, our public school system, is second to none. And we can do it. We have the resources.
Andy, where can people go in 60 seconds or less to find your answers, which I'm sure are just as good on many other topics, and to find out how they can help and how they can fund your campaign for mayor of Washington?
The easiest way is to go to the website, which we're developing as we go. Some of these ideas are going to be poured into the website. We're only about 3.5 weeks old, but it's Andy. 4DC.com, A-N-D-Y, the number 4DC.com. We invite people to come, sign up, give us whatever contribution you can make if you can, volunteer, whatever you can do would be great.
Terrific. Thank you very, very much, Andy Shalal, for coming on Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you so much, David. Appreciate it.
This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time.